Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very delighted to have back with us on the show today Mary Kay Lombino, Curator of Collections at the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center here at Vassar College, who's with us to discuss the exhibition People Are Beautiful, Photographs, Prints, and Films by Andy Warhol, on view through April 15th of this year. Welcome back to the show, Mary Kay.
Thank you.
So this is part of a multi-institutional display of Warhol's work, and I wonder if you could talk about that, how the exhibition formed and why more than one institution.
Yeah, so the overarching title for the exhibitions is Warhol Times Five, because there are five exhibitions. And
they're simultaneous.
They all happen in 2018, but they kind of stagger in terms of their openings and closings.
Oh, they do, okay.
And Vassar, People Are Beautiful, was the first exhibition, which opened just last week. And then this weekend, there will be another opening at SUNY New Paltz at the Dorsky Museum. And that's an important collaborator for us because this idea was conceived among a couple of people, myself, Reva Wolf, who's an art history professor at SUNY New Paltz and served as the curator for their exhibition, and one of the curators on their staff, because we had both done exhibitions with Warhol's work before, and we knew that we were required to do another one. And I'll explain why in just a moment. But we decided, why have two Warhol shows in the same region when we could actually collaborate? And then we also thought to invite three other museums, which are also academic museums in the Hudson Valley, to do Warhol shows as well.
Yeah,
and that includes Bard, the CCS Hessel Museum, and the University Art Museum at SUNY Albany, and the Neuberger at SUNY Purchase.
So Warhol's all over the place.
Yes, anywhere you go in the Hudson Valley, you can find a Warhol show.
So what's the impetus for the show?
All of those institutions, as well as other academic museums across the country, were given gifts by the Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts in two groupings. One was in 2008, and that was part of what they called the Photographic Legacy Program that commemorated the 20th anniversary of the foundation. And they gave away about 150 photographs to 183 museums, all amounting to 28,500 photographs by Warhol. And the stipulation was that we could reproduce them, we could photograph them, we could archive them, and then we could show them. And so we knew we had to show them. Every 10 years we have to do a show, basically, that includes these photographs. And then there was a second gift in 2013 where we all received about 8 to 10 Warhol prints into our collections, and we're also required to show those. And they're prints that were made by Warhol, signed by Warhol, but they're considered out of edition. So they're only really allowed to be used for educational purposes. And since we're all educational museums, it's great for us to be able to share them with our public.
Yeah, that's great. So it's unusual for a foundation just to give things away, works away like that, isn't it? Let's say with a Frankenthaler Foundation, we just had the Frankenthaler show. They loan things out, and they want, they want the artist's work to be seen, but on the other hand, they don't necessarily give it away like this.
No, so, they often sell it.
They often sell it,
in order to feed the functioning of the foundation.
Yeah, so that's quite amazing. It's in the spirit of Andy Warhol in a way, right?
Yes.
Who undersold everything he ever sold, I think, you know, during his lifetime.
Yeah. And the slogan that they have on their book, the Warhol Foundation, is a quote from Andy where he said, "I leave everything to the foundation." And he really did want to allow more and more people to see his work. His mission was to be world famous, which of course he is now, but his whole idea was to get more and more eyes on his work, and so this is a perfect way of doing that.
So your title is about beauty, and about human beauty in particular, and I wonder, what does Warhol's pursuit of beauty tell us about him as an artist, and about his attitude toward people in particular?
Yeah, I chose the theme based on the fact that we have so many portraits in the collection, and I really wanted to dig a little deeper into his portrait work. And the title came from a Warhol quote that was really referring to his films, specifically his screen tests, which we have on view in the galleries. And he said, "The lighting is bad, the camera work is bad, the projection is bad, but the people are beautiful." Which is really true,
true
if you look at them.
It's true.
The lighting's terrible. There's a lot of sort of high contrast, but he does choose amazing subjects. And another sort of wonderful thing that I discovered in the research was that he was sort of obsessed with beauty. Mm-hmm. Another quote says that when he would walk around, he would look at people and hear himself saying, "Oh, she's a beauty. He's a beauty." Mm-hmm. And then also, he had this party in 1965 called the 50 Most Beautiful People Party. So he really was deeply appreciative of people and loved looking at their faces and their forms and creating artwork about them. And I think it does, to really look at his portraits closely like this and so many of them in one place, mm-hmm. I think it really reveals a lot about his relationship to beauty and his interpretation of beauty, which mm-hmm. shifts with time.
Yeah.
And it begins with the typical, iconic, gorgeous Marilyn Monroe in the early 60s, right after she died. And it goes all the way till right before he died, which he died in February of 1987. Mm-hmm. In 1986, he did these portraits of himself with his fright wig and a black turtleneck, and they're very stark.
Yeah.
And they're very, they look like a death mask.
Yeah.
So if there's still a sort of essence of beauty at the end of life, I think that's really captured in those late works.
Yeah, interesting. So Warhol, you mentioned all the photographs that, you know, the foundation had, a lot of photographs, especially for the Polaroids and others too.
Mm-hmm.
So he was an obsessive collector, evidently, and also photographer, of course, collector of photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And almost, you know, he could have joined the Visual Resources Society because he had such a huge archive of photos, which he used. I mean, he had to have access to them and be able to find his way around them because he used them in his work. So, mm-hmm. so the question is, how does archiving and photography also figure in his work or behind his work? Is all his work essentially photographic in some way and archival also? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I love this question because I really do think of him, maybe not as an archivist because that seems very systematic, but certainly a biographer and an autobiographer.
Uh-huh.
He wanted to document his life, wanted to document the world around him. And so in addition to doing all these photographs, I wanted to bring up his time capsules.
Oh, yeah.
So the time capsules, he made about 600 of them in his lifetime. They were basically cardboard boxes mm-hmm. filled with about 200 to 300 items, random stuff like mm-hmm. junk mail and letters and photographs and anything from fingernail clippings to total weird objects that would go into these time capsules, which were meant to be opened at a later date to sort of describe the essence of a moment. And when you think about his work on the whole, and you think of him in the terms of this visual archivist and a photographer of the world around him, those time capsules really seem like a great example of how he really wanted to like freeze time. He was very aware of the passing of time because he had this fear of death, and he knew that so many of his idols had died young. He did end up dying young at 58. So this idea that he wanted to capture time before it could pass too quickly, encapsulate life in a way that he could hold on to, I think is more of the impetus for this type of archiving.
Yeah, it really appeals to me as a librarian, as an art librarian.
I would have loved to have been one of the people who discovered, sort of got to go through the factory after he died and discovered all this material.
Oh, yeah. I look at his work to some extent with an art historical eye. I mean, people do. And, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, the portraits, but also religious art. And I wonder how conscious Warhol is about whether he's engaging the tradition in a kind of art historical discourse. And I don't know his biography. I don't know if he ever studied art history or if he was an avid museum goer. So that's the question. I mean, is this something he's doing consciously, or does it just happen?
I think it just happened. Yeah, I mean, I think that this idea of looking back to the past, because he was religious as a boy, he definitely understood the power of an iconic image. And, you know, the Virgin Mary as this beautiful icon, which would be everywhere in the church when he was growing up. So this idea that you could make a perfect image of something and it could be emblazoned in your brain from looking at it over and over and over again.
Yeah, and he went to Mass every week, didn't he, with his mother?
So
right,
I think
right to the end. So
religious art and that type of tradition certainly seeped in, not in the way that one would think, you know, he would be looking at art history books necessarily. But we do have this great portrait of Alexander the Great in the exhibition. And that piece was done as actually a gift for someone who was retiring from the gallery world. And he created it because he wanted to sort of make a beautiful portrait of a man. Because this was a gentleman whose name was actually Alexander, who was, you know, having his retirement party. But I think it also shows that he was looking at the Western tradition of male beauty in creating that portrait.
There's a charismatic quality, of course, about Alexander and people like Alexander. And that seems to concern him generally. I had actually a show a while back where I talked to a scholar who writes about this. He's a medievalist, Stephen Jagger. And his thesis is that some works of art are, as people are, charismatic themselves. And he described a Constable painting, The Haywain. First time he recognized this, where he was in the National Gallery in London looking at The Haywain, and he couldn't tear himself away from the painting. He wanted to go into that painting and live in it. And, you know, he felt it had this kind of hold over him. In a strange way. And then, you know, he writes about charisma as an actual fact in people. And then later, when charismatic ages pass by, where you're not cultivating yourself as a charismatic person, which is what medieval education was all about, it becomes nostalgic. And then you have the age of romance, written romance. And it's about charismatic figures in the art. But it's always a kind of nostalgia. But, and anyway, Warhol is really interested in the notion of charisma and, you know, and his notion of celebrity itself. I mean, he uses it as a kind of subject matter, doesn't he?
And I think it's tied closely with beauty. Because he would often have one person who was a person who he hung out with all the time, whether it was one of his lovers or a good friend like Edie Sedgwick, and it was always someone who had amazing charisma and beauty, sort of the two tied together.
And he himself was so self-effacing and such an introvert.
Was a complete introvert, and so he was not the life of the party, but he always hung out with people who were. And then there's something else about the art having charisma. Another term for that might be, for something like pop art, you could call it wall power. So you walk into a space, and the thing that draws you in is the thing with the most wall power. That's when the bright colors, you know, having a Marilyn with blue skin tones, you're attracted to that because it sort of pops off of the wall. It also does well in the marketplace.
He starts out as a commercial artist, so he folds all this American consumerism right into this, doesn't he? And celebrates it.
He knows what sells.
So he does.
He knows how to sell things. He understands that you don't want to give away all of your information. And so that sort of ties into this idea of him being shy. I think his shyness had a little bit more to do with him not wanting to reveal everything and keeping some mystery and a sort of enigmatic personality as part of his whole package.
It's just fascinating. And that, I think it's part of the power there, in that he makes you feel that you could be beautiful too, and interesting and charismatic. So,
yeah,
you
know, just hang out with the right people, go to the right parties.
So just about what we talked about a moment ago, the art historical value, a lot of the images in our show are portraits. You know, I kept thinking of James Mundy's show of American art in the low collection that we had a while back. There was so much portraiture in it. And it kind of resonates with that, you know. So, I mean, and they're commissioned portraits. So, there's a tradition for this, of course, you know.
That's right.
Interesting.
And I think that tradition often comes from the patrons themselves. So he was certainly aware of the Medicis and their relationship, you know, with Michelangelo and those types of commissioned works. And he understood that your patron is your client and that they want a certain thing out of this commission. They want an Andy Warhol, so that he needed to use his signature style over and over again. He was actually criticized for that. Both because his style didn't change for many, many years, you know, two decades of portraiture, commissioned portraiture, and they all look somewhat similar. And he was also criticized for the fact that he would do a portrait for anyone. He wasn't discriminating. He always said yes. And he did that because it was his bread and butter, and it allowed him to make the other work that maybe he felt more compelled to do, like filmmaking and the disaster series of paintings or things that are a little less candy-colored and beautiful. But when you look at them now, you're able to really understand how he was able to shift that power relationship between the patron and the artist, because he made what he wanted to make. And they're beautiful.
There's often a conflict in portraiture, in that you feel a tension between the artist and the sitter. You know, who is this guy? You know, and But he's so kind to the people. I mean, he really does make them look beautiful.
Yeah. And I think he understood that a beautiful portrait was basically something that he could make money off of, but he could also then be proud of it.
Yeah. In the show, there are lots of shots, different shots of people just trying to get to the best view of them, which is how photography does, even when you're shooting with your iPhone and doing a selfie. You know, you can maybe take a really bad picture that you don't want to put on Facebook.
That's right.
Or you could take a really good picture. It looks much better than you actually do in life. You know?
So, if you take 100 of them, your chances are you'll get a good one. And so for those photo shoots, he would often take 100 photographs with the big shot camera.
Yeah.
It was a long photo session. Yeah. Sometimes he would basically keep taking them and keep taking them until the subject would relax, which was a big factor in it. Yeah. And also their relationship would get less tense after spending a lot of time together. And then he could say to them, you know, you look better if you turn to your right, your good side is on your other side, and really direct them. And then he would allow them to help choose which Polaroid would become the print or the painting. But he would choose about 5 or 6, so always some of his choices were in there as well.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
So there's a lot in all his work of, you know, what you would call artifice. For instance, Marilyn Monroe. I can't think of another human being, just as a person, who seemed so self-constructed and self-composed, just she herself, in a sense, as an actress. Every word, every movement she makes, you know, every camera angle always seems to me completely thought about, composed. Some of it will have to do with, you know, directors of film, that kind of thing, but she was like that herself, too. Mm-hmm. There aren't many people like that I can think of. Mae West was another one. Every kind of mincing motion you could see was studied, and every line that she delivered, it always seemed had a kind of a certain point to it.
Yeah.
And Marilyn's very like that too. So artifice is part of what he's about here, certainly, and he is an artist in that way, and he converts things into art in a sense. You know, I mean,
he's all about
makeup in a way, and performance, isn't he? Yeah,
and so. I think he admired stars like Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
Also Shirley Temple.
The first photograph
that he collected as a boy was one of these 8x10 glossies that was signed by Shirley Temple.
Yeah.
Again, a very constructed personality from a very young age.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think he saw how these superstars were able to shape their personality. He wasn't very pleased with his own looks and his own personality, and he thought, well, why can't I do that?
Yeah.
And so he recognized a sort of kindred spirit in these figures who were known so widely, but then when you dig beneath the surface, you maybe realize that their lives aren't perfect,
there's a kind of dark side to them, isn't there? Tragic with
That's
Marilyn
right.
in particular.
You so he and he yeah, didn't yeah. portray Marilyn until 1962, right after she committed suicide.
Yeah,
So it was then that he became truly enamored with her story, with her life, and I think that includes the artifice, because we saw her with a giant smile on her face, and then the next thing we know, she's committed suicide. So he sort of peels back the artifice in a way to reveal this underside of things.
Yeah, Arthur Danto has a nice line that he presents us with a dark world of radiant beings whose presence among us is redemptive.
Yes, redemption is a great word for this.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
But it is a dark world. You know, it is the world of, what was the series he did?
The Disaster Series.
Right. Yeah, it is very Catholic in that sense.
Yes, and he also, you know, if you think of his story in a weird way, sort of, is like Christ's story, because often people look at his life as before he got shot and after he got shot.
Yeah.
So before, he was all about putting himself out there into the public eye.
Yeah.
And after he was shot, he became paranoid. He was fearful of death. He was fearful of being out in public alone.
Yeah.
And he felt as though his fans could turn on him in any minute. Just to finish the metaphor with Christ is that, so if the day he got shot, he was basically crucified by his public, and then he managed to live through that, which is like his resurrection, although it was very dicey for a little while, and then after that he had sort of become much more popular in the world of art, and also the general public understood who he was after that.
Yeah.
So more accepted by a wider public.
Yeah. Interesting there. there's a kind of mechanism in that. That's part of the beauty, I think, that, you know, the tragedy, the dark side there, that it calls up an emotional kind of something. You respond to his works emotionally. And I had that response going into your first bay. I was kind of overwhelmed.
Yes.
You know, between Jackie and the Marilyn, and, you know.
And there's two different views of Jackie. You know, one where she's young and smiling. She's this broad smile. She's wearing her pillbox hat. Yeah. And then the other one, which is a much more dark image, which I believe is taken from one of the photographs of the day that JFK was shot. So, yeah, it can sometimes show the bright and the dark in one subject.
Yeah, it can. Yeah, it's part of whatever it is there that he captures. It's not all just cakes and ale sort of glamour, you know. It's another side to it.
And one thing that I found really interesting as I investigated a little further into the screen test, the films from 1964 to 66, many of those were people who hung around the factory. They were friends, acquaintances, other artists, musicians, actors, actresses. But many of them later went on to commit suicide.
Oh, interesting.
So in our grouping, and we have 12 on view, Freddie Herko is one of them. Mm-hmm. And Freddie Herko committed suicide shortly after his screen test was created.
The screen tests were sessions where he would sit someone down in front of a movie camera, sometimes walk away and just allow them to just sit there. And over time,
it was usually somewhere between 3 to 4 minute filmed portrait.
Yeah.
And I find them to be very intense because you're right up close to this person's face. And it's one thing to look at a still photograph for a long time because they don't look back.
No.
But there's something about the moving portrait which becomes much more intimate and intense.
Yeah.
And apparently those sessions were also intense because he would give them instructions like, don't blink.
Oh, okay.
Which is very hard to not blink for 3 minutes. And one of the subjects, Anne Buchanan, manages to not blink, but tears start streaming out of her eyes about a minute in.
Uh-huh.
And another time he would just say, you know, you have to stare right at this extremely bright light for 3 minutes. Or don't move a muscle.
Yeah.
You know, these things that would make them feel uncomfortable, and you can really feel that discomfort.
Yeah, interesting. So you mentioned the factory, and people know he had, you know, what he called a factory. It was a studio, basically, sort of walk-in studio, but it was a studio. And printmaking and the kinds of work he was doing requires a big space with sometimes lots of people working. So so can you talk about the factory a bit? Because in a way, he kind of alters the traditional idea of what a studio is, an artist's studio. I mean, you know, if you think of Jackson Pollock, et cetera, and those are the people he was conscious of. I mean, is that
right.
Yeah,
so Pollock was this heroic, you know, single artist who was in his studio by himself creating these masterpieces. And then the pop artists come around, and especially Warhol decided that being a sole genius was a bunch of garbage and there's no such thing. And he was very collaborative and he liked the idea of having a lot of people around. He didn't feel as though he needed to make every one of the pieces that he was going to sign.
Yeah, so that's a huge change in the idea of the artist that that he helps to affect, because we all think of, you know, the art world that way now. I mean, everything is a collective anymore, isn't it? So,
that's right, but but again, if you go back to the Florentine Renaissance and you think about the workshops and the studios then, there would often be several assistants working on a particular painting and then one artist gets to sign their name at the end.
Yeah.
So I think it harks back a little bit to that, but also in a much more contemporary idea, he wanted to work like a machine.
Yeah, exactly. It's very contemporary in that way.
He was very influenced by this idea of industrial mechanized production, which, of course, he came out of that with the advertising world and understood that you can create a Brillo box thousands and thousands of times, and every one of them will look exactly the same. He idealized that concept.
Yeah.
Of creating something where you didn't really have to make it yourself.
Yeah, interesting. Very William Morris in a way, too. You know, reminds me of it. Warhol's made wallpaper also, didn't he?
He
so
did.
He got some in the show. So
he did, and the wallpaper was a completely new idea for an artist to create wallpaper.
Yeah.
And he created about 8 during his lifetime.
Yeah, since William Morris, anyway. So,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so.
And is in terms of a pop artist creating it with the kinds of imagery that he did with, you know, the cow wallpaper. There was one with Mao. There's the self-portrait wallpaper that we have. And a few other really great ones.
Of course, the camera's part of this, too, and the mechanical part, isn't it, in a sense? Yeah, it's a mechanical thing, in a way.
You know, that's right. Yeah, just push a button, and it makes the art for you.
Yeah. So let's go through the show briefly. I mean, is this first bay. I was really moved when I stepped into it. I'm not kidding.
Oh, that's great.
Over. It doesn't happen often.
I'm glad.
So there's the first bay with iconic images, especially that first image, the big silkscreen of Marilyn. But you have Marilyn on the right also with Ingrid Bergman. And talk about religious work.
Oh, yes.
Because there's one silkscreen of her there.
It's a silkscreen, and it's a
from
Ingrid
a film
Bergman.
Still of her as a nun, of course.
And that's from the movie Nun on the Run.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yes.
Nun on the Run. I don't think I saw that one.
I haven't either.
Was that post-Rosalini, do you know? Or
early film, Nun on the Run, and the picture, there's a promotional picture for the film, and he took his silkscreen straight out of that picture.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so we have Ingrid Bergman, we've got Marilyn, we have Jackie, and then on the other wall we have a number of Polaroids that are of people who I knew as being 100% famous.
Yeah.
Dorothy Hamill and John Denver,
yeah.
Dolly Parton, Diana Ross, people like this that were superstars at the time that they were made.
Yeah.
But if you ask one of the Vassar students who any of these people are,
they don't know
who any of them are. So in a way, that wall has this nice sort of full circle commentary about fame.
Yeah. Oh, uh-huh.
That idea that Warhol had that everyone will be world famous for 15 minutes.
15 minutes, yeah.
Is really sort of exemplified through those works because while those people were complete superstars in their time, they're completely unknown to a new generation.
Yeah, he had a way with that kind of epigram or aphorism, didn't he? I mean,
yes.
15 minutes, people still know that 15 minutes. It's quite amazing.
I think because it turned out to be so true.
Yeah, it did. So there's that first bay, and then you come to the commissioned portraits in the next bay.
Yes, so that section deals with the artist relationship to their patron.
Uh-huh.
And really gets to the bottom of this idea that you could walk into his studio for a certain fee and end up with a Warhol with your face.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that was widely known among patrons of the arts.
Yeah.
But then the idea that he was very systematic about the way he created those.
Yeah.
He would always use the big shot camera even after they stopped making it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And he liked that camera because it had this diffused screen in front of the flash, and so it softened the light.
Yeah, that was a Polaroid, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was a type of Polaroid.
And it was a Polaroid made in the early 70s that was prone to breaking down, so Polaroid stopped making it.
Yeah.
But the corporation knew that Warhol loved this camera. They would find ones that were not in use. They would sort of rehab the ones that were breaking for him and constantly sent him film and cameras so he could continue to use it into the 80s, which he did. And he would spend hours creating just the right atmosphere to create the best portrait with these women, mostly women.
Yeah, it's a really powerful part of the show there. And then you move into the show, and then there is the ladies and gentlemen portraits, which are really contemporary, I have to say. You know, they're all about gender, of course.
Yeah.
Mostly photos of people in the studio, men mostly, in drag, right?
That's right,
yes,
men in drag. Yeah. And that's a fantastic series, and I'm so thankful that I was able to include it in the exhibition because I spoke to a number of students before I completed the checklist for the exhibition. And Vassar students that I spoke with thought of Warhol as a very sort of conventional white male artist.
Mm-hmm.
And we think of him as alternative because he was gay in the 60s,
and
that was a very alternative lifestyle.
Yeah.
But, you know, you click the clock ahead to 2017 and he seems like just a white guy. And so in order to really...
Or Jasper Johns.
He's not that much different than, you know, Rauschenberger Johns in their eyes. And so I thought, but that's not true. Of course, he was very alternative, and the Ladies and Gentlemen series helps to sort of illuminate that, I think.
Yeah.
And what he did was he asked his associates to go to a well-known bar in Midtown, Times Square area, called the Gilded Grape, where a number of drag queens hung out. Some of them engaged in prostitution and were probably hard up for money. And they were invited back to the studio and told that they would be given $50 to get their picture taken.
Uh-huh.
And they thought, that's like a great deal.
Yeah.
So they were very happy to do it. Mm-hmm. And then the big differences I see between those Polaroids and the ones that are in the artist and patron section are that he gave them complete control.
Oh.
They could wear their makeup and their clothing and pose however they wished.
Yeah.
Whereas these rich patrons would come in and he would ask them to take off all of their jewelry and he would put white powdered makeup all over them and pose them. So, strangely, he gave agency to people who were disenfranchised.
Uh-huh.
And the people who had power, he sort of flipped the
control
upon himself.
Yeah.
It's interesting. What's interesting about those photos for me is, you know, the drag queens, they're not entirely successful with their makeup.
That's right.
So, you know, you see 5 o'clock
way.
Shadows, you see hair on their chest, etc. So you get this sense of artifice because, you know, they are really made up. There is that part of it, and there are part of Andy's art.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you see their human side and the part that doesn't make it over the line in a way, you know, into that kind of notion of beauty, which reflects back on the Marilyn and everything else. There's this other side that's there, you know, that isn't beautiful, I suppose you'd have to say, you know. Or it is. It's beautiful because it's not beautiful, maybe you could say that, you know, so.
Yeah, and
it's
I
so
think
human, you know.
We're used to seeing trans people who have really successfully.
Yeah, they know how to put on their makeup.
They really do.
And
things have changed in that department.
Yeah.
So it's very jarring for us to see this kind of, the mask is revealed a bit. But then there are these two portraits of Bob Colicella.
Oh, yeah.
And he's dressed in drag. And he was a perfectly straight guy who was pretty straight-laced, but Andy convinced him to put on a wig and dress up as a female and put all this makeup on and sort of ham it up for the camera, which I think was a very interesting component because it showed that it can be fun, it can be silly, it doesn't have to be so serious.
Yeah, no, in the 60s, we used to say it's all about dressing up, you know, everything, you know, however, you know, so it's all costume, you know.
That's right, and he was also obsessed with the fashion world, which is on view in the second gallery as well, because again, it's sort of about if you have the right outfit on and your hair or your wig looks fantastic, and, you know, the certain earrings or high heels that you have on can really make or break how you're seen by your public.
Yeah, interesting. And then there are at least one image, if not more, of Andy himself in drag in the show, right?
Yes.
There's one by Ari
Markopoulos.
Ari Markopoulos, yeah. That's a beautiful photo.
Isn't that lovely?
It's so sad, in a way, looking at him there sitting. And, so, and it's very Cindy Sherman-esque, isn't
it? Yes, it is. He's sitting kind of in a big room alone.
Yeah.
One thing I noticed is he's wearing a sheet across his torso, which is what he would often ask his subjects to do. And then he's holding a tape recorder. So it's very iconic in that it's very Andy to be recording everything that's happening. And he's wearing a wig, a women's wig, not the fright wig that he has on at the end, and some lipstick. And he has a sort of sad look on his face.
Yeah. And then we've got a little show by Billy Name here also, right?
Yes.
Of works, you know, Billy was one of his major assistants. And we've had a show about Billy, per se, you know, in the past. I remember with the one that Jan Edelman was here.
That's right.
It in,
And this exhibition sort of uses a number of the pieces that were in that show.
Yeah.
That show happened in 1989.
That long ago, good Lord.
Yeah, it was 2 years after Warhol died.
Yeah.
And it was created because when they were going through the factory after his death, they found this silver trunk. And Billy Name was the only person who ever lived at the factory.
Yeah.
And he kept his stuff inside this trunk.
And
he left shortly after Andy was shot in the late 60s and left the trunk behind. So it was found by the people forming the foundation and given back to Billy.
Mm-hmm.
And in it were all these photographs and works that Billy had made. And a number of them were donated to our collection.
Yeah. And Billy, we have to thank for the silver in the silver studio, right?
Yes.
He painted the factory silver. And
he painted it silver, and he said he was inspired by seeing the Mid-Hudson Bridge be painted silver every year.
Oh, really? That's so interesting.
Yeah, so that's a nice little Poughkeepsie story
Was he
that.
From here?
He grew up in Poughkeepsie,
Oh, did
yes.
he? That's so interesting.
His father was cut hair. He had a barbershop on Main Street. And that's how we met Andy. He used to have haircutting parties, and Andy went to one of them.
We've produced so many unusual people.
Ed
Wood, you know?
Yes.
So then you've got the gallery with the screen tests,
yes.
which is really striking. One follows the next.
It's really fun to be able to show films in the galleries, which we don't do very often here.
No.
But what I've discovered is that it works very nicely. That last room can be kind of converted into a little theater.
Yeah, it works fine.
And people can sit down and really watch. There's about 50 minutes of films there.
Uh-huh.
And I find the fact that they're very large to be a really interesting aspect. I think we see Warhol films a lot of times on our computer screens or on a flat screen.
Yeah.
But being able to project them large is how they're really meant to be seen. Yeah.
And you're showing some of his films, his actual film.
That's right.
Later in the semester.
I'm collaborating with the film department, which has been wonderful. And there'll be a film night in March right after break.
Yeah.
And we're going to be showing three films that night.
There was a point in his career when Warhol became intent on video as a medium, and during the opening you had one of his assistants, Vincent Fremont, come, who is Warhol's video guy and lecturer, and present an excerpt from one of his early cable programs done for the Madison Square Garden Network. I think it's fair to say that if Warhol had made this breakthrough, television would never have been the same just from that clip. I mean, it was like MTV, but it was like MTV times 10.
Very fast cuts.
All about celebrity and exciting you with the idea of celebrity, all the people that he was going to have on, sort of like a Johnny Carson type thing, but totally different.
Yeah, and that was in 1986 that he was creating that television series, and I just thought, it's wonderful to have television be one of the last mediums that he worked with before he died.
Yeah.
So in our exhibition, we have prints, photographs, films. Of course, he's very well known for his paintings. Yeah. And then here was this other medium that he was just getting started with right before he died.
And it's just kind of natural to him, in a perfect form in a way.
Yeah, it's great to see those. You can find a few of them on Vimeo and on YouTube.
Yeah.
But they're hard to see, so I was glad that Vincent Fremont was able to show us clips of those.
Yeah, it was a nice opening, nice talk. So just to sort of sum up, what is it about Warhol that makes him so exciting? I mean, I can see you're excited about him, and he stays like that, you know.
Yes.
I don't know what it is. I mean, Danto says one of his famous essays is The End of Art, and he says Warhol changed the notion of what art is dramatically, contemporary art.
And I think he did, but there are still people who, I think, look at Warhol and think there's no reason why he should be so famous. But I think what they're not seeing is that he was the first to do many of these things. Certainly the first to really infuse contemporary art with all this popular imagery.
Yeah, completely breaks down the line between high and low. I mean, it had been talked about before, but nobody had ever really just crashed through and said, you know, that we've got to change things.
That's right, that a soup can is art, and a Brillo box that looks exactly like a Brillo box is also art.
So it's funny that, you know, Lichtenstein was a little earlier in starting out and working with the same kind of idea, but nothing like the way Warhol
interesting that you bring up Lichtenstein, because there's this great story that Irving Blum tells. So Irving Blum was the head of the Ferris Gallery in Los Angeles in the 60s, and he was the very first one to show Andy's soup cans in 1962 in Los Angeles. He had a show of all of them, and he'd gone to New York with Larry Gagosian, and they went and looked at Lichtenstein's work and at Warhol's in the same visit. And first he saw Lichtenstein, and then he went to Andy's studio, and Andy was making cartoon imagery. And he said, oh, that's interesting. There's this other guy, Roy Lichtenstein, making cartoon imagery. And when Andy heard that, he stopped. He didn't want to be like anyone else. Which is
That's interesting.
Interesting shift, because then right from there, he went to the soup cans, because this was the early 60s. And then Irving showed them and sold one or two. And then he had this revelation one day coming into the gallery, and he decided he shouldn't be selling them individually. They should stay together. So he actually bought back the few that he'd sold, and he ended up buying them all directly from Andy. He didn't have enough money. I think they were like $100 a piece. He paid them about $100 a month for about a year, and he acquired them all, and then he hung on to them for decades, and eventually sold them to MoMA for million dollars. And it was a really important moment to imagine that it was about the repetition. It was about seeing them all en masse. It was similar to going to the grocery store and seeing that enormous number of soup varieties that you could choose from.
Another breakthrough, in a way, the notion of the multiple there.
The notion of the multiple, when it sort of relates back to consumerist society and this enormous amount of choice that we're given as consumers.
And he liked Campbell's soup. He really liked it, didn't he?
He used to eat it all the time. It's a very American thing.
It always tastes the same. It's always good.
But back to your question of sort of like, why Warhol? Why are we still so compelled to continue to investigate his work? And we are, because the Whitney's doing a giant retrospective of his work in 2019.
Oh, they are. Uh-huh.
So it's he's really having another moment right now. Is because he is so American.
Yeah.
There's something about his work that really speaks to American ideas, mm-hmm. American consumers, and American products.
Yeah. You're talking on Thursday,
okay.
Right? Yes, yeah.
Oh, yes. So I'll start with that, and mm-hmm. I'll just go through the events.
That's tomorrow.
So if anyone's interested, tomorrow mm-hmm. at 5 p.m. as mm-hmm. part of our late night at the Lehman Loeb,
yeah.
I will be giving a walkthrough of the exhibition at 5 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that lots of people come to that. And then we have events continuing for the evening because it's part of ModFest.
Yeah.
And then other events that are coming down the pike on March 29th, mm-hmm. which is the Thursday after spring break, there's a film screening with three films by Warhol, and they're being introduced by Gerard Malanga,
mm-hmm.
who was also a friend and collaborator of Warhol's in the factory.
Uh-huh.
And that's at 6 p.m. in the Rosenwald Film Theater. And there'll be a reception after that at 8 o'clock here at the museum.
Yeah.
And then lastly, the Warhol Times 5 collaborative team has put together a symposium, mm-hmm. which is called Displaying Warhol, Exhibition as Interpretation. And it starts on Thursday, April 12th, with a keynote lecture by Blake Gopnik, and that's at 6 p.m. in Taylor Hall, mm-hmm. room 102, with a reception at the museum afterwards.
Uh-huh.
And the following day, if anyone's interested in going to SUNY New Paltz, April 13th, there'll be panel discussions from 10 to 4 at SUNY New Paltz, and it will include all of the curators from Warhol Times 5, as well as a number of other Warhol scholars.
Sounds great. So first thing is your talk tomorrow, though.
Yes.
Which is always a great thing to go to have a curator who's responsible for a show actually take you through and talk about things.
Yeah.
It's better than plugging the, headphones into your ear and wandering around.
That's right, because you can ask questions.
You can, yes. Okay, so I'd like to thank you, Mary Kay, again, for visiting with us on the show to talk about your exhibition, People Are Beautiful, Photographs, Prints, and Films by Andy Warhol, open through April 15th.
Yes, thanks. It's always a pleasure.
Okay, great.